You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos. 13 lectures, translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on the 3rd of July, 1921. Following yesterday's considerations, we are now in a good position to address a fundamental fact of our living and being. It is just when we set about looking more exactly at the relationships between ourselves and the outer world that we always experience the riddle of how it is that we can't see through into the true being of the outer world. This outer world appears before us in its phenomena and events, and even if we are only slightly interested in how we know things, we have to assume that the true nature of reality lies hidden behind these phenomena in the colors, sounds, and warmth of the world. Something like a veil is there, and only behind this veil is the true nature of reality to be found. On the other hand, there is a similar riddle in relation to our inner life. I pointed out during the last few days how the inside of our body reveals the riddle of our organs once we truly enter the depths of our organism. It nevertheless remains a fact that, as far as ordinary consciousness is concerned, we cannot penetrate deeply enough into our inner being to be able to perceive the nature of our lungs, liver, and so on, in the way that was described yesterday. Now, the fact that there are two riddles, the riddle of the impenetrability of the outer world and the inscrutability of our inner world, can be understood in the context of the wholeness of our human nature. Once we address this wholeness, we will see that only one side of it appears to us here, between birth and death, the other side lying between death and a new birth. Let us begin by looking at what appears to us of our own nature between birth and death. We must rely on a fact of our inner life that belongs to our normal daily consciousness, our memory. I spoke yesterday of how this faculty of memory is really based on reflections from the surfaces of our internal organs. We need this faculty of memory for our inner life. I have often referred to facts that show how any interference with this faculty of memory can undermine our normal life between birth and death. This was to illustrate how our capacity for remembering can be extinguished. There are well-known cases of this happening. You can look up numerous cases like this in books on psychology. It is a well-known fact that this can happen, and the phenomenon is much more widespread than we think. We have only to imagine that for such people, without their knowledge in the normal sense of the word, these processes are like your own experience of falling asleep to waking up every night. Consciousness is extinguished. However, an abnormal discontinuity of consciousness like this has an extraordinarily significant impact on one's whole awareness of personality. The person concerned can no longer deal with the experience undergone. Later in life, it appears horrible. We can see from this how important it is for everyday life between birth and death to have continuity of consciousness, with the exception of when we are asleep. Continuity of consciousness is connected with our memory. We need our faculty of memory to carry on with our normal lives. There is another fact to consider when one has undertaken an occult schooling. This is that one is obliged to develop powers of soul that can extinguish this normal memory for the moments when spiritual vision is experienced. As long as we are in possession of our ordinary powers of memory, we cannot look into the spiritual world. Students undergoing occult development usually have the experience that to begin with, as they embark on their process of development, they have certain visions. they complain later that they no longer have those visions, that they have ceased. That is due to the fact that there is no faculty of memory for such visions, if they are true visions, and not hallucinations. It is not possible to remember a vision, because it is something real. If you look at a piece of chalk and then look away, you have the image in your memory. If you want to have the chalk before you, the real chalk, you will have to turn back to the sense perception. You have to have the real object in front of you. Your memory will be of no use to you for this reality. If you touch a hot iron, you will burn yourself. You can remember the heat as much as you like, but you will not burn yourself. Since the vision brings you into contact with something real, not just an image, you will have to return to it. The issue is that one has to return to the vision rather than trying to remember it, since the vision is a genuine occult experience and cannot be a memory. One can only return to it indirectly. We can say to ourselves, before I had the vision, I went through the following experience in ordinary consciousness. That is something we can remember, and we have to repeat this stage in the process until we reach the point where the vision came. Then we arrive at that point. It cannot occur directly again, but in a way we have to go back over the process. Many do not take account of that. They believe one can remember a vision like anything else. In the course of occult development, one even has to undermine one's memory. That is absolutely necessary and cannot be avoided. It follows that people striving for an occult development of this kind must above all ensure that they are sensible in ordinary life. That is, that they are in possession of sound common sense, a healthy memory, and no quasi-mystical tendencies. Anyone who indulges in nebulous mystical dabbling in ordinary life is not suited to undergoing an occult development. One certainly has to be able to remember the events of the day quite clearly, and then one can venture to pursue visions of the kind that are inaccessible to memory. The cautions that apply to an occult development have to do with the nature of the process itself. In summary, memory belongs to ordinary consciousness and to a normal life between birth and death. Now, I can sketch out for you how it is for a person in possession of the faculty of memory. I shall illustrate it roughly like this, and there's a drawing on page 101. What I am now outlining is not present as such, but can be perceived within the etheric body. This line shows what is in fact spread out over the whole body. And you would then have to imagine that everything that is outside the organs lies between the head, that is, sense perceptions or sense impressions, and this line. This line is intended to represent the boundary line for the human organs. Here things are reflected back, and beyond this line you will find heart, lungs, liver, and so on. Here things are reflected back. Symbolically, that line represents the boundary of our faculty of memory. You can literally imagine. Inside us, we have a delicate form of skin. It is actually the fine boundary line between the etheric and astral bodies. In reality, it is not spatial, but it can be represented like this in a sketch. Everything that we perceive is bounced back by the forces within the organs behind this boundary. It is thus reflected along this boundary line, and we are then unable to see through it in ordinary consciousness. We cannot see through the skin of memory into what lies within us. Memory covers up the inner workings of the human being. It has to do this because we would otherwise be unable to live normally in ordinary life between birth and death. Memory closes off what lies within us from ordinary consciousness. The moment this memory is interrupted, that is, The moment there is a tear in its fabric, as is the case with occult development, we become able to see into what lies within our organs in the way I described yesterday. Now, we have the answer to the riddle of why we are unable to look through to what lies within us. This inner aspect of ourselves needs to be covered over, or we would not be normal during life between birth and death, since we do need our faculty of memory. The reflecting activity of our memory obscures the inner aspect of ourself. That is what you need by way of an answer to this riddle. Looking toward the other side, the side that faces the outer world, what we see spread out before us is the veil of the senses, which we cannot see through either. Let us look at it this way. How would it be if we could look into the world, and instead of seeing the veil of the senses, we could see through the multiple tears in it into the being of the world? We would constantly be flowing through the boundaries of our senses into the nature of things themselves. We would merge with them. We could not distinguish ourselves from them. What would then be the consequence? If we could no longer distinguish ourselves from the world around us, we would be unable to develop feelings of love, because they depend on us not flowing into the other, but remaining an individuality, separate, but nevertheless capable of feeling our way toward the other. We are organized so as to be capable of love between birth and death. In the process of occult development, this capacity for love must then be replaced by imagination, inspiration, and intuition. In a sense, we have to break through our capacity for love. If it were not for love, our ordinary life would be totally ruined. We would become cold-hearted. For that reason, it is essential that anyone undergoing occult development in this direction, above all else, develops the highest possible capacity for love. Once this has been developed to the extent that it cannot be lost as a result of occult development, but on the contrary, that one can sustain it despite occult development, one can then brave the task of penetrating through the veil of the senses and looking into objective reality. The second riddle, then, lies open to your soul. To be human, we must be organized so that we are capable of both memory and love. Since we have to be capable of love, we cannot look beyond the veil of the senses, and since we have to be capable of remembering, we cannot see into our own insides. That is the truth in relation to the utterly false Kantian philosophy. Kant wanted to examine human subjectivity and staked out a few completely abstract concepts which are meaningless. The reality is that we have to see ourselves as beings who are capable of loving and remembering in our life between birth and death. That is how we can learn what is alive in our feelings and what lives in love. That is also what we have to carry with us through the gates of death. It is our very reason for living on earth, to perfect these two faculties within us. Given that we have to keep our perceiving and our thinking apart by means of our faculty of memory, and so are obstructed by the veil of the senses, we develop our conscious life mainly by means of our heads, and in a sense, as human beings, we are entirely head organizations. This conscious life does not get beyond thoughts. Each thought becomes an image in our memories. That is, however, as far as we can progress. Our thoughts are stored in that way, and it is only because they are stored in that way that we can retrieve them. Our thoughts are held up, and our normal life between life and death relies on us not letting our thoughts descend into our organs. The forces at work in our thinking do descend, as I described yesterday, but the thought itself, living in us in the form of an image, we cannot release down. It is at the moment of death that our thoughts become what they should not be in ordinary consciousness, namely imaginations. The faculty of imagination, which we strive for so intensely during occult development, becomes available to us when we die. All our thoughts become images. We inhabit a whole world of images, and we can only understand someone who has died once we have acquired the language of images. Immediately after death, thoughts transform into images. We then spend some time with these images between death and a new birth. Gradually, they turn into inspiration. In this way, the soul continues to grow. Then we begin to perceive the music of the spheres. The music of the spheres becomes a reality for us. We live in the world of cosmic sounds. Finally, we grow together with the objectively spiritual cosmos. That is also the point at which, after this experience of intuition, the world midnight hour strikes, which I spoke of yesterday. Now the journey back begins, and our intuition is prepared to take into itself what we had gradually left behind from our time here on the earth. You see, once we have passed through the gate of death, we live by forces which are different from those that we describe as will forces here on earth. We live our way into forms which are more of a cosmic nature. Our own will is absorbed. It gradually fades away. But once we have reached the world midnight hour, having passed through the stages of imagination, inspiration, and intuition, and reached the turning point of life between death and a new life, our intuition begins to absorb will forces again. Our thinking takes on a quality of will, and this will increasingly fill the soul, which now can wrestle its way through to inspiration and then to imagination. Once it has reached the stage of imagination and has inhabited it for a while, our thinking ripens to the point where it can reincarnate. The metabolic limb system of the previous life then emerges transformed from the world of images, as I described earlier. You can see how we pass through stages that are striven for in occult development toward the world midnight hour, and then descend in the opposite direction through to the stage of imagination and come to the formation of thoughts, which when we are embodied. Throughout this whole process, we have been absorbing will forces. Now, as we reappear in physical form, we can see what has been working into us from the cosmos, what we have drawn from our previous incarnation. Once we have reached the point of a new incarnation, just before conception, we have an imagination, and one that is saturated with will. Our head and all that belongs to it emerges from the imagination, having essentially already been there in the form of an image. Our will takes hold of the new limbs and metabolic system. Our head consists principally of crystallized, rigidified thoughts. What remains in the rest of our human being is organized will. We can only really be awake in our heads. After all, you are familiar with your thoughts which appear in ordinary consciousness. This concept can be put to any one of our contemporaries. What goes on in our will, however, is just as unknown to people as what goes on in their sleep. When you raise an arm, how much of what goes on in doing so are we aware of in ordinary consciousness? We perceive that the arm is raised, the concept is clear, but the act of will involved remains asleep, comparable with our sleep experience between falling asleep and waking up. We can say then that in respect of our metabolic and limb systems, we are also asleep by day. It is only in our heads that we fully awaken. These elements all work together. Conventional science today speaks of a certain kind of logic, such as concept, judgment, and conclusion. The well-known conclusion that features in all accounts of logic refers to the famous logical personality. All men are mortal, Caesar is a man, therefore Caesar is mortal. That is the conclusion. Each element of the conclusion is also a judgment. All men are mortal is a judgment. Caesar is a man is a judgment. Therefore, Caesar is mortal is a judgment. The whole thing is a conclusion. Man, Caesar are concepts. If we were to ask an intelligent and well-educated person today, we must always refer to such clever people, for they set the tone of debate, this person would say, all this takes place in our nervous systems. Our nervous system is the medium for concept, judgment, and conclusion, even of our feelings and our will. The facts, however, do not match the conventional view. Only ideation as such is actually the business of our head. When you make a judgment, you have to feel your way through your ether body into your legs to find out where you stand. Your judgments are not carried out by your head, but by your legs, specifically your etheric legs. Anyone making a judgment, even when lying down, stretches out his etheric legs. Making a judgment is not a function of our head, but of our legs. No one would believe this today, but it is nevertheless true. Coming to a conclusion is a function of our arms and hands, all that lifts a human being up beyond what an animal also has. An animal can stand on its legs, and an animal is itself a judgment, but it cannot come to a conclusion. We can. That is the reason for our arms being free. That is what they are for, not walking. We have our arms free so that we can come to conclusions. What takes place when we stand with our etheric legs in the process of judgment? What takes place when we move our astral arms in forming a conclusion are both only reflected in our heads as ideation and remain there as such. For judgment and conclusion to come about in us, we need to involve the whole human being, not just our nerve sense nature. If you take that into account, you will see that we come to judgments and conclusions by means of our limb system. Fundamentally, these are acts of will, and this will emerges from a more ill-defined part of us than the faculty of ideation. Our experience when we come to a conclusion is just like when we wake up in the morning. A conclusion has been drawn up from the very depths of our being, that part of our life which has grown old in the passage from our previous life into this one, and is now active in our heads, is what makes us capable of ideation. This aspect of us is old in relation to the cosmos when we are born. Conversely, the fact that our powers of will have been renewed relates to our growing young in relation to the cosmos. The head that we carry is always a reminder of our previous incarnation. It represents what is old. Our metabolic limb aspect is what our will has captured on its way into this incarnation and is passed on through the mother's body. Our other aspect, the head, is in fact formed within our mother out of the cosmos. One need only study conventional empirical embryology to find this confirmed. Our head is an image of the cosmos and is formed by external forces. To deny this is the equivalent of saying that it is nonsense to maintain that the earth's magnetism sets the needle on a compass. If a physicist wants to explain the movements of the needle on a compass, he will start with the needle. Similarly, a physiologist, an embryologist, or a biologist will focus on the mother's body if they want to explain the embryo. That is as pointless as trying to explain the movements of the needle on a compass on the basis of the needle alone. We have to take into account the whole cosmos. Only our head is initially fully developed, and the rest of our body is simply appended. That in turn is what our will has taken by conquest, having attempted to seduce the forces of imagination during its passage through life between death and a new birth, from the moment of the world midnight hour onward. If we look at the human being sketched out here, we will find everything that relates to thinking and perception above the delicate skin of memory, and everything that relates to our will below. Our will works its way up out of the unconscious and can only be found in the way we set out yesterday. That is where our will works upward. We are asleep in relation to our will. We thus have the human being appearing as a duality in life between birth and death. Whilst it is true that we are monads, we have this quality in respect of the whole cosmos, and it is one which we have to keep developing in our process of evolving. It must be continually renewed. For all practical purposes, we are dualistic between birth and death. On the one hand, thinking and perception, on the other, will and natural disposition. This leaves us, in reality, as the point of intersection between two worlds. If you take an honest look at yourself, and at what is in your consciousness at any given moment in your life, you will find that it is a collection of your memories, all that you have experienced in the time since your second to sixth year. What pours out from below there, what pours out from our will, is love, the capacity for love. In this sense, we exist at the intersection of memory images and love. Fundamentally, we consist of this. Up here is a world of cosmic thought, and below it there is a world of cosmic will. As human beings, we are continually under attack by Lucifer from the aspect of our will, and by Ahriman from the aspect of our thinking. And there's an illustration. Ahriman is constantly trying to turn us into nothing but heads. Lucifer is constantly trying to knock our heads off so that we cannot think, and so that everything flows out in warmth via the heart, overflowing with cosmic love, which then pours itself out into the world as a cosmically rapturous being. In our present day, much vaunted culture, we are largely under the influence of Ahriman. These Ahrimanic influences have always been felt, particularly by sensitive people. When I was very young, I once spoke to an Austrian poet who was very well known at the time. He had a fine sense for trends in our culture, and he expressed it in the form of a metaphor which he experienced as a reality. He said to me, I can still hear it as if he had said it today. Quote, people of our time are heading toward a terrible fate that will befall us if we continue as we are. People will gradually lose their physical skills. They will no longer be able to walk properly. They will always be on wheels and moving about mechanically. They will also lose the dexterity of their hands. Everything will become technical. Just as a muscle wastes away when it is not used, all our limbs will gradually shrivel up, and we shall be just heads. These heads will become ever bigger, and in the end we shall all be rolling about with the crippled remains of the rest of our organism. Close quote. This was the nightmarish vision of the Austrian poet Hermann Rollet, was his name, and he depicted it quite graphically, because he was so troubled by the idea that our culture would one day turn us into rolling heads. Yet there is something very true about this. The truth is that there are indeed extraordinarily powerful forces at work in our time, which would like our heads to become more and more developed. They are not having much success with our physical heads, but are doing much better with our etheric heads. The fact is that the Ahrimanic forces at work in our time are trying to turn us entirely into head people, so that they can completely transform us into just thinkers. In a person developing healthily, the opposite pole is her will pole, which is constantly counteracting this tendency when we die, so that the will can take hold of our thinking. Our thinking is not yet ready to be isolated. When we are born, we have gathered new will forces, but our thinking detaches itself and finds our head. Our will forces take hold of the rest of our bodies. While we live on earth, there is a constant interaction of will and thought within us, Our will takes hold of our thinking, and we have to carry this composite of thinking and willing back through death again. Ahriman would like to prevent us from doing this. He would like our wills to remain separate so that only our thinking becomes fully developed. In that case, we would lose our individuality. If in the end it really came to that, which is what Ahriman wants, we would completely lose our individuality. We would arrive at the moment of death with a highly exaggerated, instinctively developed power of thought. But we would not be able to hold on to it, and Ahriman would be able to take hold of it and integrate it into the rest of the world, so that this thinking would continue to work on in the world left behind at our death. This really is the fate that threatens humanity, if the materialism of our day continues unchecked. The Ahrimanic powers will become so strong that they will be able to steal the human faculty of thinking and integrate it into the earth in such a way that it will go on working, and that the earth which is supposed to pass away will be consolidated and remain earth. Ahriman is working to counter the words, quote, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word will not pass away," close quote. His intention is that these words will be thrown away, and that heaven and earth will remain. This can only be achieved if human thinking is stolen from us and we are deprived of our individuality. If Ahriman were left to continue working in the way he had been since 1845 in particular, our brains would become increasingly rigid and we would live as if within a framework of compulsive thoughts, materialized thoughts, as I set out yesterday. This would become evident in education, where people would be guided in a way that no longer left them scope for mobility in their thinking and left them with completely fixed ideas once they had reached a certain age. Now I ask you, have we not already reached a point where this has been realized in many respects? Consider how fixed our ideas already are today. Is it still possible for people to learn anything much? Their thoughts have become so rigid, so fixed, that there is not a great deal that can be taught. Their thoughts are already in the service of Ahriman, who is making every effort to enhance this process, turning thoughts into compulsive thoughts. One very effective way in which these thoughts have a compelling influence, particularly in the sciences, is through the concept of atomism. According to this, what lies behind the veil of the senses is not the spirit, but all kinds of atoms, swirling, whirling atoms. There is, of course, no other way of passing through the veil of the senses than by thinking. But Ahriman has confused people to such an extent that their thoughts have become materialized. People no longer believe that this world of atoms is a man-made thought construct, but think of it as a reality. This is how they project their thoughts into the world around them. This is the world made Ahrimanic. Our science today is Ahrimanic through and through. From time to time in the course of life, this is brought to our attention in a most terrible way. For example, I was given a manuscript some time ago, perhaps 35 years ago. It was a very learned manuscript. It was supposed to categorize human differential, this is a true story, which, when integrated, would result in a human being. Thus, integrating components from feet to head would produce a human being. The doctor who brought this to my attention went on to say, quote, "I can introduce you to the author. I worked with him at the clinic," close quote. When I did meet him, he said, quote, "Yes, that is correct. I have experienced this myself. I am composed entirely of differential atoms, and they are everywhere to be found. I myself am really an integral," close quote. He imagined himself as being composed entirely of atoms, a form of consciousness that was intellectually Ahrimanic. This is, one could say, simply a rigidified atomistic system. When this manuscript was brought to me, I was reminded that there is an all-encompassing formula devised by Laplace, namely, that it should be possible to calculate, starting from processes at an atomic level, not just by integrating from foot to head, but by integrating from the beginning of the world to its end, by inputting certain data when Caesar crossed the Rubicon, and that sort of thing. Simply by arranging data within a global formula. This whole way of thinking is appallingly similar to the account this man gave of himself as an integral enclosed between feet and head. This alone gives us a glimpse, if we look at it rightly, into the Aramanization of our culture. It needs to be countered, of course, and that can only happen if we bring an imaginative quality to our concepts, so that they do not remain purely abstract. That will mean that when we cross the threshold of death, we already bring a picture consciousness with us, and can find a connection with what the world needs. The alternative would be that humanity runs the risk of losing itself, and that what should develop into the will flowing into our thinking life and becoming individualized will then become mineralized, no different from earthly matter. The earth would become a cosmic being, but the soul life of humanity would end up in a great cemetery. One has, from time to time, seen the development of culture from a wider perspective, particularly so in our own time. Anyone who is in a position to see trends in human development more exactly will know how rapidly we are in fact approaching this ossification of our culture. I should take this opportunity to mention that until the year 869 AD and the 8th General Ecumenical Council in Constantinople, our understanding of ourselves included body, soul, and spirit. Now, at this council for the Occident, it was stated that we should not believe that we are composed of a body, soul, and spirit, but only of body and soul, with the soul having some spiritual qualities. This, then, became generally accepted. During the Middle Ages, it was heresy to believe that we are composed of body, soul, and spirit. Today, professors of philosophy will state as a matter of objective science that human beings are beings of body and soul. This objective, in quotes, science is nothing more than a resolution of the 8th Ecumenical Council. The ultimate objective is still to be realized. It would be true to say that as a consequence of this 8th Ecumenical Council, humanity has lost its awareness of the spirit, which must now be regained by our own efforts. If, however, we continue in the direction I have outlined, we shall also lose our awareness of our human soul. This awareness had already been lost to the materialists of the 19th century to such an extent that it was said, our brains secrete thoughts in the way that our liver secretes gall. Only physical processes were taken into account. Moreover, there are already tendencies, unknown to most people, but working underground, where all kinds of societies are operating with this in mind, toward bringing about something similar to the 8th Ecumenical Council of Constantinople, namely, to declare that we are not beings with a body and a soul, but only a body, and our soul is something that develops out of our body. It follows that it is impossible to educate the human soul. Some material means must be found to inject into us so that after a certain age, we can receive what it takes to unfold our talents. This tendency is certainly present in our time. It is the next step on the Aramanic path of development, no longer to found schools for teaching to take place, but to facilitate the injection of certain substances. This can be done. There is no question of it not being possible. It can be done, but the result would be to turn us into automata. This would enormously accelerate what otherwise could only be achieved by means of thought control, an education aimed at controlling how we think. Substances are already available that would enable us, if injected with them at, let's say, 7 years old, to skip primary school. Our thinking would, however, be automated. We would become extremely clever, but would have no awareness of it. This cleverness would simply be a fact of life. There are already people who do not care whether someone has an inner life or not, so long as the person goes about his business outwardly and gets this or that done. People of our time who have a preference for Ahrimanic culture, and they do exist, see this as an ideal to be striven for. What could be more attractive to people with this attitude, which is becoming increasingly widespread, than to find a vaccine, rather than to bother with teaching children year after year? These things have to be expressed in drastic terms. Failing that, people of our time will not awaken to the direction which we are heading. A vaccine of this kind would have the effect of loosening our etheric body within the physical. The moment that happens, the interplay of the universe and the etheric body would become extremely active, and we would become automata. Here on earth, our physical bodies need to be educated by an act of spiritual will. The educational methods employed in Waldorf schools were devised in full awareness of present-day intentions to automate us. In this respect, they are indeed intended to be a cultural driving force leading humanity back toward spirituality. In essence, it can be said that the most important thing in our time is to take particular care that cultural life among us becomes spiritual in nature. We should therefore have the courage to pay careful attention to every sign of improvement in the self-development of individual people. I have often emphasized in other contexts how people have the tendency today to strive to establish a routine rather than a conscious way of life. A routine is essentially a mechanization of life. I was recently very pleased to read that there are still people who value a conscious way of life over and above everyday routine. There was an item in the news about how Edison tested his people for qualities that would prove valuable in practical life. He wasn't in the slightest interested in whether or not a salesperson was good at bookkeeping. That, he said, was something one could learn in 3 weeks if one was otherwise skillful and clever. All these specialisms were of no interest to him. They could all be developed in time. He was right. What he did present people with, if he was interested in knowing what they could achieve in practical life, were questions like, quote, "How big is Siberia?" close quote. So if he wanted to see if someone was a good bookkeeper, he would not ask if the person could draw up a balance sheet, but "How big is Siberia?" Or, if a room is 5 meters long, 3 wide, and 4 meters to the ceiling, how many cubic meters of air does it enclose? There would be other similar questions. He put questions such as, what stands at the place where Caesar crossed to the Rubicon? Questions of general knowledge, and depending on how well the candidate could deal with questions of general knowledge like that, Edison would hire them as bookkeepers, or to some other position. He was not at all interested in whether or not someone was good at bookkeeping, since he knew that if the candidate could deal with a question like that, it would be proof that she had not wasted her time at school, but had, as a child, grown up with mobility of thought, and that was what he required. That is the direction in which practical life should go. Recently, we have been heading in the opposite direction, constantly on the lookout for specialists, so that in the end one could despair of finding someone to deal with practical tasks. People could no longer be found who would contemplate anything outside the box in which they had chosen to be confined. It has to be said that here, too, we must work toward mobility of thinking. Once we are moving in that direction, our thoughts will not become sclerotic, and Ahriman will have a challenge on his hands. You will see for yourselves, however, how few Edisons there are in life who work on such practical lines. What matters is working toward imaginative concepts. Anyone following that course will be unable to say he could not understand spiritual science. It is precisely the nudge that we have to give ourselves to shift from the abstract to imaginative concepts that will enable us to understand something like this. The Earth developed out of the Moon, Sun, and Saturn. At the same time, feelings will begin to infuse our inner life with imaginative concepts and imaginations. It was recently reported here that a critic of anthroposophy had said that it was not a science because it drew on the whole human being for its research. Any science as such should, however, be based solely on our intellect. You can see here that the critique starts with the definition of what a science is, that is, that it should not be based on the faculties of the whole human being, and then goes on to say, if it is drawing on all our faculties, it is wrong. Using this approach, one could, of course, define anything out of existence. The whole point is that we must extend our one-sided culture of the head into one that encompasses the whole human being. It is essentially just a flaw in our consciousness that leads to this head culture, which then extends into practical life. The mistaken belief that we come to judgments and conclusions with our heads is what leads us to this head culture. We come to judgments with our legs and conclusions with our arms. Once it is known that the whole human being is involved in coming to a judgment and a conclusion, then there will be no further resistance to the idea that genuine truth must be founded on the whole human being. That is what I wanted to bring to your attention today. The end of Lecture 7.